to know if she had ever crossed paths with Agent Marco, and if so, when. I told the receptionist that I had no appointment, but was willing to wait. She said to take a seat while she notified Miss Fair's secretary of my request for a 10-minute meeting. The fact that Fair had a secretary underscored her lofty position in the Kennedy regime. Most prosecutors I knew had no real administrative help and were lucky if they got to share a pool secretary. I pulled out my phone and sat down on one of the plastic chairs that had populated the waiting room since before I was a licensed lawyer. I had email to check and texts to write, but the first thing I did was call Cisco to see if his Indians had picked up anything on the drive downtown. "I was just talking to my guy," Cisco reported. "They didn't see anything." "Okay. Doesn't mean they're not there. This was just one drive. We might need to send you out to get a little separation, and then we'll know for sure." "Really? I don't have time to be running all over town, Cisco. I thought you said these guys were good." "Yeah, well, the Indians that were up in the cliffs didn't have to watch the 101 freeway. I'll tell them to stick with it. What's your schedule anyway?" "I'm at the DA's office now, and I don't know how long I'll be here. After this, I'm going out to Fulgoni's office to meet Junior."
"Where's he located?"
"Century City."
"Well, Century City might work. Nice wide boulevards out there. I'll tell my guys."
I disconnected and opened up the email on my phone. There were an assortment of messages from clients who were currently incarcerated. The worst thing to happen to defense attorneys in recent years was the approval from most prisons of email access for inmates. With nothing else to do but worry about their cases, they inundated me and every other lawyer with endless emails containing questions, worries, and the occasional threat. I started weeding through it all, and 20 minutes went by before I looked up to change focus. I decided I'd give it a whole hour before giving up on Leslie Fair. I went back to plowing through my email and was able to clear out a good chunk of the backlog, even answering a few of them in the process. I was 45 minutes into it, with my head down, when I saw a shadow reflect on my phone screen. I looked up, and there was Detective Langford looking down at me. I almost flinched, but I think I managed to look unsurprised to see him. "Investigator Langford?"
"Holler, what are you doing here?"
He said it like I was some kind of squatter or other nuisance who had previously been warned to move on and not come back. "I'm waiting to see someone. What are you doing here?"
"I work here, remember? Is this about Lacoste?"
"No, it's not about Lacoste, but what it is about is none of your business." He signaled me to stand up. I stayed seated. "I told you I'm waiting for somebody."
"No, you're not. Leslie Fair sent me out to see what you want. You don't want to talk to me, then you're not talking to anybody. Let's go. Up. You can't use our waiting room to operate your business. You've got a car for that."
That answer froze me. He'd been sent out to me by Fair. Did that mean Fair had knowledge of what was happening behind the scenes on the Gloria Dayton murder case? I'd come to inform her, but she might already know more of what was going on than me.
"I said let's go," Langford said forcefully. "Get up, or I'll get you up."
A woman who had been sitting two chairs away from me stood to get away from what she determined was about to become a physical extraction. She sat back down on the other side of the room.
"Hold your horses, Langford," I said. I'm going.
I slipped my phone into an inside pocket of my jacket and grabbed my briefcase off the floor as I got up. Langford didn't move, choosing to stay close and invade my personal space. I made a move to go around him, but he sidestepped, and we were face to face again.
"Having fun?" I said. "Miss Fair doesn't want you coming back here either," he said. "She's not in court anymore, and doesn't need to have anything to do with douchebags like you. Understand?"
His breath was rancid with coffee and cigarettes. "Sure," I said. "I get it." I moved around him and out to the elevator alcove. He followed me and watched silently as I pushed the down button and waited. I looked over my shoulder at him. "This may take a while, Langford."
"I've got all day."
I nodded. "I'm sure you do." I turned back to look at the elevator doors for a moment and then glanced back over my shoulder at him. I couldn't resist.
"You look different, Langford."
"Yeah? How so?"
"From last time I saw you, something's different. You get hair plugs or something?"
"Very funny. But thankfully, I haven't seen your ass since LaCosta's first appearance last year."
"No, something more recent. I don't know."
That's all I said. I turned back to concentrate on the elevator doors. Finally, the light went on overhead and the doors opened, revealing a car with only 4 people on it. I knew it would be packed wall to wall and well over the safety code weight limit by the time it got down to the lobby. I stepped on the elevator and turned back to look at Langford. I doffed an imaginary hat in saying goodbye.
"It's your hat," I said. "You're not wearing your hat today."
The elevator doors closed on his dead-eyed stare. Chapter 20. The confrontation with Langford left me agitated. On the ride down, I shifted my weight from foot to foot like a boxer in his corner waiting to answer the bell. By the time I reached the ground floor, I knew exactly where I had to go. Sly Fulgoni Jr. could wait. I needed to see Legal Siegel. 40 minutes later, I stepped off another elevator onto the 4th floor at Menorah Manor. As I passed the reception desk, the nurse stopped me and told me I had to open my briefcase before she would allow me to go down the hall to Legal's room.
"What are you talking about?" I said.
"I'm his lawyer. You can't tell me to open my briefcase." She responded sternly and without any give.
"Someone has been bringing food from the outside to Mr. Siegel. Not only is it a violation of the health and religious policies of this facility, it is a risk to the patient because it interferes with a carefully considered and scheduled nutrition plan."
I knew where this was headed, and I refused to back down myself.
"You're calling what you feed him and what he pays for here a nutrition plan? Whether patients enjoy all aspects of the food here is beside the point. If you want to visit Mr. Siegel, you will be required to open your briefcase.
If you want to see what's in my briefcase, you show me a warrant."
"This is not a public institution, Mr. Haller,
and it's not a courtroom. It is a privately owned and operated medical facility. As head nurse on this ward, I have the authority to inspect anyone and anything coming through those elevator doors. We have sick people here, and we must safeguard them. Either open your briefcase, or I'll call security and have you removed from the premises."
To underline the threat, she put her hand on the phone that was on the counter. I shook my head in annoyance and brought my briefcase up onto the counter. I snapped open the twin locks and flipped up the top of the case. I watched her eyes scan its contents for a long moment.
"Satisfied? There might be a stray Tic Tac in there somewhere. I hope that won't be a problem."
She ignored the crack.
"You may close it, and you may now visit Mr. Siegel. Thank you."
"No, thank you."
I closed the briefcase and walked down the hallway, pleased with myself, but knowing I would now need a plan for the next time I actually did want to get food into Legal. I had a briefcase in a closet at the house that I had taken in barter from a client once. It had a secret compartment that could hold a kilo of cocaine. I could easily hide a sandwich in there, maybe 2. Legal Siegel was propped up on his bed watching an Oprah rerun with the sound on too loud. His eyes were open, but seemed unseeing. I closed the door and came over to the bed. I waved my hand up and down in front of his face, fearful for a moment that he was dead.
"Legal?"
He came out of the reverie, focused on me, and smiled.
"Mickey Mouse! Hey, what'd you bring me? Let me guess. Tuna avocado from Gus's in Westlake."
I shook my head. "Sorry, Legal, I don't have anything today. It's too early for lunch anyway."
"What? Come on, give.
pork dip from Kohl's, right?
No, I mean it. I didn't bring anything. Besides, if I did, Nurse Ratched out there would have confiscated it. She's on to us and made me open my briefcase.
Oh, that bag of wind. Denying a man the simple pleasures in life?
I put my hand on his arm in a calming gesture. Take it easy, Legal. She doesn't scare me. I've got a plan, and I'll hit Gus's on the way in next time, okay?
Yeah, sure.
I pulled a chair away from the wall and sat down next to the bed. I found the remote in the folds of the bedding and muted the television.
Thank God, Legal said. That was driving me nuts.
Then why didn't you turn it off?
Because I couldn't find the damn remote. Anyway, why did you come see me without bringing me any sustenance? You were just here yesterday, right? Pastrami from Arts in the Valley.
You're right, Legal, and I'm glad you remember it.
Then why'd you come back so soon?
Because today I need sustenance. Legal sustenance.
How do you mean?
The Lacoste case. Things are happening, and it's getting hard to see the forest for the trees. I ticked off the cast of characters on my fingers. I've got a shady DEA agent out there, a crooked DA investigator, a cartel thug, and a disbarred lawyer. Then I've got my own client in the clink, and the victim in all of this is the only one I really like, or liked, in the first place. To top it all off, I'm being watched, but I'm not exactly sure by who.
Tell me about it.
I spent the next 30 minutes summarizing the story and answering his questions. I backed up beyond the last update I'd given him and then brought the story forward, going into much finer detail than I had previously given. He asked many questions as I told the story, but never offered anything back. He was simply gathering data and holding his response. I took him right up to the confrontation I'd just had with Langford in the DA's office waiting room, and the uneasy feeling I had that I was missing something right in front of me. When I was finished, I waited for a response, but he said nothing. He made a gesture with his frail hands, as if to throw the whole thing up into the air and let the wind take it. I noticed that both of his arms were purple from all the needles and the prodding and poking they did to him in this place. Getting old was not for the weak.
That's it, I said. Just throw it to the wind like a bunch of flower petals?
You've got nothing to say?
Oh, I've got plenty to say, and you're not going to like hearing it.
I motioned with my hand, inviting him to hit me with it all.
You're missing the big picture, Mouse.
Really? I said sarcastically.
What is the big picture? Now, you see, that's the wrong question, he lectured. Your first question should not be what, but why. Why am I missing the big picture?
I nodded, going along only grudgingly. Then why am I missing the big picture?
Let's start with the report you just gave on the state of your case. You said it took that rookie shortstop you hired out of the five and dime to make you see things the right way at the staff meeting this morning.
He was talking about Jennifer Aronson. It was true that I'd hired her out of Southwestern, which was housed in the old Bullock's department store building on Wilshire. It engendered her nickname, but referring to the law school as a five and dime was a new low. I was only trying to give credit where credit was due, I said. Jennifer may still be a rookie, but she's sharper than any three lawyers I could have hired out of SC.
Yeah, that's all well and good. She's a good lawyer. I grant you that. The thing is, you always expect yourself to be the better lawyer, and deep down you hold yourself to that. So when all of a sudden this morning it's the team rookie who sees things with clarity, then that gets under your skin. You're supposed to be the smartest guy in the room.
I didn't know how to respond to that. Legal pressed on.
I'm not your shrink. I'm a lawyer. But I think you gotta stop hitting the booze at night, and you gotta get your house in order.
I stood up and started pacing in front of the bed.
Legal, what are you talking about?
My house is...
Your judgment and your ability to cut through the obstacles in front of you are, at best, clouded by an outside agenda.
You're talking about my kid? My having to live with knowing my kid wants nothing to do with me? I wouldn't call that an agenda.
I'm not talking about that per se. I'm talking about the root of that. I'm talking about the guilt you carry over all of it. It is impacting you as a lawyer, your performance as a lawyer, as a defender of the accused. And in this case, most likely, the wrongly accused.
He was talking about Sandy and Katie Patterson and the accident that took their lives. I leaned down and grabbed the iron railing at the foot of his bed with both hands. Legal Siegel was my mentor. He could tell me anything. He could dress me down lower than even my ex-wife, and I would accept it.
"Listen to me," he said. "There is no more noble a cause on this planet than to stand for the wrongly accused. You can't fuck this up, kid."
I nodded and kept my head bowed.
"Guilt," he said. "You have to get by it. Let the ghosts go, or they'll take you under, and you'll never be the lawyer you were supposed to be. You will never see the big picture."
I threw up my hands.
"Please, enough with the big picture crap. What are you talking about, Legal? What am I missing?" "To see what you're missing, you have to step back and widen the angle. Then you see the bigger picture."
I looked at him, trying to understand.
"When was the habeas filed?"
he asked quietly.
"November." "When was Gloria Dayton murdered?"
"November," I said it impatiently. We both knew the answers to these questions.
"And when were you papered by the lawyer?"
"Just now, yesterday."
"And this federal agent you talked about, when was he served?"
"I don't know if he was served, but Valenzuela had the paper yesterday."
"And then there's the phony subpoena Fulgoni cooked up for the other girl from back then."
"Kendall Roberts, right."
"Any idea why he would dummy up paper for her and not you?"
I shrugged. "I don't know. I guess he knew I'd know if it was legit or not. She's not a lawyer, so she wouldn't. He'd save the costs of filing with the court. I've heard of lawyers who roll that way."
"Seems thin to me."
"Well, that's all I got off the top of..."
"So 6 months after the habeas was filed with the court, they put out their first subpoenas?"
"I tell you, if I ran a shop like that, I'd have been out of business and on the street."
"It's not the timely exercise of the law, that's for sure."
"This kid, Fulgoni, doesn't know his ass from..." I stopped in mid-sentence. I had suddenly caught a glimpse of the elusive big picture. I looked at Legal. "Maybe these weren't the first subpoenas." He nodded.
"Now I think you're getting it," Legal said.
Chapter 21. I told Earl to drop down to Olympic and take me out to Century City and Sly Fulgoni Jr.'s office. I then settled in with a fresh legal pad and started charting timelines on the Gloria Dayton murder case and the Hector Moya habeas petition. Pretty soon, I saw how the cases were entwined like a double helix. I saw the big picture.
"You sure you got the right address, boss?"
I looked up from my chart and out the window. Earl had slowed the Lincoln in front of a row of French provincial-style townhouse offices. We were still on Olympic, but on the eastern edge of Century City. I was sure the address carried the correct zip code and all the cachet that came with it, but it was a far cry from the gleaming towers on the Avenue of the Stars that people think of when they imagine a Century City legal firm. I had to think there would be buyer's remorse for any client who arrived here for the first time and found these digs. Then again, who was I to talk? Many was the time I dealt with buyer's remorse when my clients learned I worked out of the back seat of my car. "Yeah," I said, "this is it." I jumped out and headed toward the door. I entered a small reception room with a well-worn carpet, leading from the front of the reception desk in twin paths to doors to the right and left. The door on the left had a name on it I didn't recognize. The door on the right had the name Sylvester Fulgoni. I got the feeling that Sly Jr. was splitting the space with another attorney, probably the secretary too, but at the moment there was no secretary to share. The reception desk was empty. "Hello?" I said. Nobody replied. I looked down at the paperwork and mail piled on the desk and saw that on top was a photocopy of Sly Jr.'s court calendar. Only I saw very few court dates recorded on it for the month. Sly didn't have much work, at least work that took him inside a courthouse. I did see that he had me down for a deposition scheduled for the following Tuesday, but there were no notations about James Marco or Kendall Roberts. "Hello," I called out again. This time I was louder but still got no response. I stepped over to the Fulgoni door and leaned my ear to the jamb. I heard nothing. I knocked and tried the knob. It was unlocked and I pushed the door open, revealing a young man seated behind a large, ornate desk that bespoke better times than the rest of the office presented.
"Excuse me, can I help you?"
the man said, seemingly annoyed by the intrusion. He closed a laptop computer that was on the desk in front of him, but didn't get up. I stepped 2 feet into the office. I saw no one else in the room. "I'm looking for Sly Jr.," I said. "Is that you?"
"I'm sorry, but my practice is by appointment only. You'll have to set up an appointment and come back."
"There's no receptionist."
"My secretary is at lunch, and I'm very busy at the..." "Wait, you're Haller, aren't you?"
He pointed a finger at me and put his other hand on the arm of his chair like he was bracing himself in case he had to cut and run. I raised my hands to show I was unarmed. "I come in peace." He looked like he was no more than 25. He was struggling to produce a reasonable goatee and was wearing a Dodgers game jersey. It was obvious he didn't have court today, or maybe any day.
"What do you want?"
he asked. I took a few more steps toward the desk. It was gigantic and way too big for the space, obviously a leftover from his father's practice in a bigger, better office. I pulled down one of the chairs positioned in front of the desk and sat down.
"Don't sit. You can't..."
I was seated.
"All right, go ahead."
I nodded my thanks and smiled. I pointed at the desk. "Nice," I said. "A hand-me-down from the old man?"
"Look, what do you want?"
"I told you, I come in peace. What are you so jumpy about?" He blew out his breath in exasperation.
"I don't like people barging in on me. This is a law office. You wouldn't want people just..."
"Oh, that's right. You don't even have an office. I saw the movie." "I didn't just barge in. There was no secretary. I called out and then tried the door."
"I told you, she's at lunch. It's the lunch hour. Look, can we get this over with? What do you want? State your business and then leave."
He dramatically chopped the air with his hand. "Look," I said, "I'm here because we got off on the wrong foot, and I apologize. It was my fault. I was treating you and your father like we were foes on this case. But I don't think it's got to be that way. So I'm here to make peace and to see if we might be able to help each other out. You know, I show you mine if you show me yours." He shook his head.
"No, we're not doing this. I have a case and you have whatever the fuck you have, but we're not working together."
I leaned forward and tried to hold eye contact, but the kid was all over the place. "We have similar causes of action, Sly. Your client, Hector Moya, and my client, Andre Lacoste, stand to benefit by our working together and sharing information." He shook his head dismissively.
"I don't think so."
I looked around the room and noticed his diplomas framed on the wall. The print was too small for me to read from a distance, but I didn't think I was dealing with an Ivy Leaguer here. I decided to put some of what I was thinking and had charted in the car out there to see how it went over. My client is charged with the murder of Gloria Dayton, who figures importantly in your habeas petition. The thing is, I don't think he did it. Well, good for you. It's not our concern. I was beginning to suspect that his use of our did not refer to him and Hector Moya. It was a reference to Team Falcone, Mr. Inside and Mr. Outside. Only Mr. Outside didn't know habeas corpus from corpus delicti, and I was talking to the wrong man. I decided to go ahead and hit him with the big question. The question that had emerged when I stepped back and looked at the big picture. Answer one question and I'll go. Last year, did you try to subpoena Gloria Dayton before she was murdered? Falcone emphatically shook his head. I'm not talking to you about our case. Did you have Valenzuela do it? I told you, I'm not talk- I don't understand. We can help each other. Then you talk to my father and try to convince him, because I'm not at liberty to discuss anything with you. You have to go, now. I made no move to get up. I just stared at him. He made a gesture with his hands as if pushing me away. Please, go. Did somebody get to you, Sly? Get to me? I don't know what you're talking about. Why'd you dummy up the subpoena you had Valenzuela serve on Kendall Roberts? He brought a hand up and pinched the bridge of his nose as if trying to ward off a headache. I'm not saying another fucking word. All right, then I'll talk to your father. Call him right now. Put him on speaker. I can't just call him. He's in prison. Why not? He talked to me last night on a phone. This raised Sly's eyebrows. Yeah. When I was with Trina. His eyebrows arched again and then flatlined. There you go. He can only call out after midnight. Come on, man. He's got a cell phone up there. Half my clients do. Big fucking secret. Yeah, but at Victorville they've got a jammer. And my dad's got a guy who turns it off for him. But only after midnight. And if you've got guys with phones, then you know you never call in. They only call out when it's safe. I nodded. He was right. I knew from experience with other incarcerated clients that cell phones were common contraband in almost all jails and prisons. Rather than rely on finding them through constant body cavity and prison cell searches, many correctional institutions employed cellular blockers that eliminated the use of the phones. Sly Sr. obviously had a friendly guard, most likely a guard paid to be friendly, with his hand on the switch during the midnight shift. This was a confirmation that the call from Sly Sr. the night before was coincidence and did not come about because he was having me followed. It meant someone else was. How often does he call you? I asked. I'm not telling you that, Sly Jr. said. We're finished here. My guess was that Sly Sr. called every night with a to-do list for the following day. Junior did not appear to be much of a self-starter. I was dying to get a look at that diploma so I could see what law school gave him a skin, but decided it wasn't worth the effort. I knew lawyers from top schools who couldn't find their way out of a courtroom, and I knew night school lawyers who I'd call in a heartbeat if it was ever my wrists in the cuffs. It was all about the lawyer, not the law school. I stood up and pushed the chair back into place. Okay, Sylvester, this is what you do. When Daddy calls tonight, tell him I'm coming up to see him tomorrow. I'm going to register at the gate as his lawyer. Moya's too. You and I are co-counsel. You assure Daddy that I am seeking cooperation of our two camps, not an adversarial relationship. Tell him he better take the interview and hear me out. Tell him to tell Hector the same thing. Tell him not to turn down these interviews, or things are going to get uncomfortable for him up there in the desert. What the fuck are you talking about? Co-counsel? Bullshit! I stepped back toward the desk and leaned down, two hands on the mahogany. Sly Jr. leaned back as far as he could in his chair. Let me tell you something, Junior. If I drive 2 hours up there
and this doesn't go down exactly as I just said it's to go down, then two things are going to happen. One is that the jammer is going to start staying on all night, leaving you high and dry down here without a clue about what to do, and what to file, and what to say. And second, the California Bar is going to take an intimate interest in this little arrangement you've got with Daddy. It'll be called Practicing Law Without a License for Daddy. For you, it will be practicing law without knowing the first fucking thing about the law. I straightened up and made to leave, but then turned right back to him. And when I talk to the bar, I'll throw in that phony subpoena, too. They probably won't like that much, either. You're an asshole. You know that, Holler? I nodded and headed back to the door. When I need to be. I walked out, leaving the door wide open behind me. Chapter 22. The Lincoln was waiting where I had left it. I jumped into the back seat and was greeted by the sight of a man sitting across from me and directly behind Earl. I glanced at my driver's eyes in the mirror and saw an almost apologetic look in them. I drew my attention back to the stranger. He wore aviator sunglasses, worn blue jeans, and a black golf shirt. He had a dark complexion matched with dark hair and a mustache. My immediate thought was that he looked like a cartel hitman. The man smiled when he recognized the look in my eyes. "Relax, Holler," he said. "I'm not who you think I am." "Then who the hell are you?" I asked. "You know who I am." "Marco?" He smiled again. "Why don't you tell your driver to take a walk?" I hesitated a moment, and then looked at Earl in the rear view. "Go ahead, Earl, but stay close, where I can see you." What I really wanted was for Earl to be able to see me. I wanted a witness because I didn't know what Marco was about to pull.
"You sure?" Earl asked.
"Yeah," I said. "Go ahead." Earl got out of the car and closed the door. He walked a few feet forward and leaned against the front fender of the car with his arms folded. I looked across the seat at Marco. "Okay, what do you want?" I said. "Are you following me?" He seemed to ruminate on the questions before deciding to answer.
"No, I'm not following you," he finally said. "I came to check out a lawyer who's been trying to paper me, and here I see you. You and him working together."
It was a good answer because it was plausible. It avoided confirmation that Marco had been the one who had jacked my car, and he seemed pleased with it, even though he had not convinced me. I put Marco in his mid-40s. He carried an aura about him, a sense of confidence and knowledge, like a guy who knows he's two moves ahead of everybody else. "What do you want?" I asked again.
"What I want is to help you avoid fucking up in a major way."
"And what way is that?" Marco proceeded as though he had not heard the question.
"Do you know the word sicario, counselor?"
He said it with full Latin inflection. I glanced away from him and out the window, then I looked back. "I've heard it said, I think."
"There's no real English translation for the word, but it's what they call the cartel assassins down in Mexico. Sicarios."
"Thanks for the education."
"Down there, the laws are different than we've got up here. Do you know that they have no legal code or provision that allows a teenager to be charged as an adult? No matter what they do, no charges as an adult and no incarceration beyond the age of 18 for the crimes they commit as children."
"That's good to know for the next time I'm down there, Marco, but I practice law right here in California."
"Consequently, the cartels recruit and train teenagers as their sicarios. If they get caught and convicted, they do a year, maybe two, and then they're out at 18 and ready to go back to work. You see?"
"I see that it's a real tragedy. No way those boys come out rehabilitated, that's for sure." Marco showed no reaction to my sarcasm.
"At 16 years of age,
Hector Aronde Moya admitted in a courtroom in Culiacan in the state of Sinaloa that he had tortured and murdered 7 people by the time he was 15. 2 of them were women. 3 of them he hung in a basement, and 4 he set on fire while they were still alive. He raped both the women, and he cut all of the bodies up afterward and fed the remains to the coyotes in the hills.
And what's that have to do with me?
He did all of this on orders from the cartel. You see, he was raised in the cartel, and when he got out of the Penta at 18, he went right back to the cartel. By then, of course, he had a nickname. They called him El Fuego, because he burned people.
I checked my watch in a show of impatience. That's a good story, but why tell it to me, Marco? What about you? What about the...
This is the man you conspire with Fulgoni to set free. El Fuego.
I shook my head. I don't know what you're talking about. The only person I'm trying to set free is Andre Lacoste. He is sitting in a cell right now, charged with a murder he didn't commit. But I'll tell you this much about Hector Moya. You want to put the motherfucker away for life, then make the case fair and square in the first place. Don't...
I cut myself off and raised my hands, palms out. Enough.
Just get out of my car now, I said quietly. If I need to talk to you, I'll talk to you in court.
There's a war, Haller, and you have to choose which side you're on. There are sacrifices that...
Oh, now you're going to talk to me about choices. What about Gloria Dayton? Was she a choice? Was she a sacrifice?
Fuck you, Marco. There are rules, rules of law. Now get out of my car.
For 5 seconds, we just stared at each other. But finally, Marco blinked. He cracked his door and slowly backed out of the car. He then leaned down and looked back in at me.
Jennifer Aronson.
I spread my hands as if waiting for whatever it was he still had to say.
Who?
He smiled.
Just tell her if she wants to know about me, she can come right to me. Anytime. No need to sneak around the courthouse, pulling files, whispering questions. I'm right here. All the time.
He closed the door and walked off. I watched him as he went down the sidewalk and turned the corner. He didn't go into Fulgoni's office, even though he had claimed that was the reason he was in the vicinity and had spotted me. Soon, Earl got back in behind the wheel.
You okay, boss?
I'm fine. Let's go. He started the car. My frustrations and feelings of vulnerability got the best of me, and I snapped at Earl.
How the hell did that guy get in the car?
He came up and knocked on the window. He showed me the badge and told me to unlock the back. I thought he was going to put a slug in the back of my head.
Great. And you just let me jump in the back with him.
There was nothing I could do, boss. He told me not to move.
What did he say?
A bunch of self-deluding bullshit. Let's go.
Where to?
I don't know. Head toward the loft, for now. I immediately got on the phone and called Jennifer. I didn't want to scare her, but it was clear that Marco knew of her efforts to background him and check other cases he had been involved in. The call went straight to message. As I listened to her recorded voice, I debated whether to leave a full message or just tell her to call me. I decided it would be best and perhaps safest to leave her the message, so she got the information as soon as she turned on her phone. Jennifer, it's me. I just had a little visit from Agent Marco, and he is aware of your efforts to document his history. He must have friends in the clerk's office or wherever you're pulling records. So I'm thinking you might want to keep what you've got on that, but switch back to Moya. I'm going to see him tomorrow in Victorville, and I'd like to know all there is to know by then anyway. Let me know you got this. Bye. Cisco was next, and this time my call went through. I told him of my encounter with Marco and asked why there had been no heads up from the Indians who were supposedly watching me for a tail. I wasn't too pleasant about it.
No warning, Cisco. The guy was waiting for me in my fucking car.
I don't know what happened, but I'll find out.
He sounded as annoyed as I was.
Yeah, do that, and call me back.
I disconnected the call. Earl and I rode in silence for a few minutes after that, with me replaying the Marco conversation in my head. I was trying to figure out the motives for the visit from the DEA agent. First and foremost, I decided, was the threat. He wanted to put a chill on my team's efforts to research his activities. He also, it would seem, wanted to steer me away from the Moya case. He probably felt that Moya's conviction and life sentence were relatively safe with the inexperienced Sly Fulgoni Jr. at the helm of the habeas petition. And he was probably right. But hitting me with the description of Moya as the worst thing this side of the devil was just a front. Marco's motives weren't altruistic. I didn't buy that for a moment. All in all, I concluded that Marco was trying to spook me because I had spooked him. And that meant we were pointed in the right direction. Hey, boss? I looked at Earl in the rear view. I heard you telling Jennifer in that message that you're going up to Victorville tomorrow. That true? We're going up? I nodded. Yeah, we're going. First thing in the morning. And in saying so out loud, I also sent a silent fuck you to Marco. My phone buzzed, and it was Cisco, already back with an explanation. Sorry, Mick, they fucked up. They saw the guy arrive and get in the car with Earl. They said he showed a badge, but they didn't know who he was. They thought he was a friendly. A friendly? The guy has to badge Earl to get in the car and they think he's a fucking friendly? They should have called you on the spot so you could call me and stop me from coming out with my goddamn zipper down. Already told them all of that. You want me to pull them off now? What? Why? Well, it seems pretty clear we know who jacked your car, right? I thought about Marco's claim that he'd just happened to see me while he was checking out Fulgoni because of the subpoena. I didn't buy that for a moment. I agreed with Cisco. Marco had jacked my car. Might as well save the dough, I told Cisco. Pull him off. They weren't much in the early warning department anyway. You want us to pull the GPS off the car, too? I thought about that for a moment, and my plans for the next day. I decided I wanted to taunt Marco, show him I was unbowed by his little visit and unspoken threat. No, leave it for now. Okay, Mick. And for what it's worth, the guys are really sorry. Yeah, whatever, I gotta go. I disconnected. I had noticed out the windshield that Earl was cutting through Beverly Hills on Little Santa Monica Boulevard on the way to my house. I was starved and knew we were coming up on Papa Jake's, a hole-in-the-wall lunch counter that made the best steak sandwich west of Philadelphia. I had not been there since the nearby Beverly Hills Superior Court was shuttered in the state budget crisis, and I had lost business that would bring me to the area. But in the meantime, I had developed a legal seagull-type craving for a Jake steak with grilled onions and pizzaiola sauce. Earl, I said, we're going to make a stop for lunch up here. And if that DEA agent is still following, he's about to learn the best-kept secret in Beverly Hills. Chapter 23. After the late lunch, I was through for the day. My calendar was clear, and I had no further appointments. I considered heading back downtown and seeing if I could line up a visit with Andre Lacoste to go over some things related to the upcoming trial. But the occurrences of the past few hours, from Legal Siegel's lecture to the meet with Sly Jr. and the surprise visit from Marco, led me toward home. I'd had enough for the time being. After Earl dropped me and took off in his own car, I went inside and changed into clothes more appropriate to hiking through the wilds of Fryman Canyon. It had been a long while since I'd seen my daughter in the goal at practice. I knew from the school's online newsletter that there were only a few weeks left in the season, and the team was getting ready for the state tournament. I decided to go over the hill to watch and maybe escape from thoughts on the Lacoste case for a while. But escape was delayed, at least on the ride up Laurel Canyon Boulevard.
Jennifer called me back and told me she had received my message and my direction to step back from the search on Marco. I'd asked for some court files on other ICE cases because the stuff on Pacer seemed incomplete, she explained. I bet one of those counter clerks called him and told him.
Anything's possible, so just stick with Moya for now.
Got it.
Can you get me whatever you've got by the end of the day? I've got a long drive up to the prison tomorrow and I could use the reading material.
Will do.
There was a hesitancy about the way she said it, as though there was something else she wanted to say. Anything else? I asked.
I don't know. I guess I'm still wondering if we are going the right way with this. Moya is a better target for us than the DEA.
I knew what she meant. Casting suspicion on Moya in the upcoming trial would be a lot easier and possibly more fruitful than throwing the light on a federal agent. Aronson was getting at the fine line between seeking the truth and seeking a verdict in your client's favor. They weren't always the same thing.
I know what you mean, I said.
But sometimes you gotta go with your instincts, and mine tell me this is the way to go. If I'm right, the truth shall set Andre free.
I hope so.
I could tell she was not convinced, or something else was bothering her. You okay with this? I asked. If not, I can handle it, and you just deal with the other clients.
No, I'm fine. It's just a little weird, you know? Things are upside down.
What things?
You know, the good guys might be the bad guys, and the bad guy up in prison might be our best hope.
Yeah, weird. I ended the call by reminding her to get the summaries of her research to me before I hit the road to Victorville the next morning. She promised she would, and we said goodbye. 15 minutes later, I pulled into the parking lot at the top of Fryman Canyon. I grabbed the binoculars out of the glove box, locked the car, and made my way down the trail. I then left the beaten path to get to my observation spot. Only when I got there, the rock I had positioned had been moved, and it looked like someone had been using the spot, possibly to sleep at night. The tall grass was matted down in a pattern that would fit a sleeping bag. I looked carefully around to make sure I was alone, and moved the rock back to the way I'd had it. Down below, soccer practice was just getting underway. I put the binoculars to my eyes and started checking out the north net. The goalkeeper had red hair and a ponytail. It wasn't Haley. I checked the other net, and there was another goalkeeper, but she wasn't my daughter either. I wondered if she had switched positions and started scanning the field. I checked each player, but still didn't see her. I let the binoculars hang from my neck and pulled my phone out. I called my ex-wife's work number at the Van Nuys division of the district attorney's office. The pool secretary put me on hold and then came back and told me Maggie McPherson was unavailable because she was in court. I knew this was not correct because Maggie was a filing deputy. She was never in court anymore. One of the many things I was held responsible for in the relationship, if it could still be called a relationship. I tried her cell next, even though she had instructed me never to call the cell during work hours unless it was an emergency. She did take this call.
Michael?
Where's Haley?
What do you mean? She's at home. I just talked to her.
Why isn't she at soccer practice?
What?
Soccer practice. She's not there. Is she hurt or sick? There was a pause, and in it, I knew I was about to learn something that as a father, I should have already known.
She's fine. She quit soccer more than a month ago.
What?
Why?
Well, she was getting more into riding, and she couldn't do both and keep up with her schoolwork, so she quit.
I thought I told you. I sent you an email.
Thanks to the multitude of legal associations I belonged to and the many incarcerated clients who had my email address, I had more than 10,000 messages sitting in my email file. The messages I had cleared earlier in the day while in the DA's waiting room represented only the tip of the iceberg. So many were unread that I knew there could have been an email about this, but I usually didn't miss messages from Maggie or my daughter. Still, I wasn't on firm enough ground to argue the point, so I moved on.
You mean horse riding? Yes, hunter jumper. She goes to the LA Equestrian Center near Burbank.
Now I had to pause. I was embarrassed that I knew so little about what was going on in my daughter's life. It didn't matter that it had not been my choice to be shut out. I was the father, and it was my fault regardless. Michael, listen. I was going to tell you this at a better time, but I might as well tell you now so I know you got the message. I've taken another job, and we're going to move to Ventura County this summer. The second impact on a 1-2 punch combination is supposed to land harder, and this one did. When did this happen? What job? I told them here yesterday. I'm giving a month's notice, then I'll take a month off to look for a place and get everything ready. Haley's going to finish the school year here, then we'll move. Ventura was the next county up the coast. Depending on where they moved to, Maggie and my daughter would be anywhere from an hour to an hour and a half away. There were some distances even within Los Angeles County that could take longer to travel because of traffic. But still, they might as well have been moving to Germany. What job are you taking? It's with the Ventura DA's office. I'm starting a digital crime unit, and I'll be back in court again. And of course, it all came back on me. My losing the election had dismantled her career at the LA County DA's office. For an agency charged with the fair and equal enforcement of the laws of the state, the place was one of the most political bureaucracies in the county. Maggie McPherson had backed me in the election. When I lost, she lost too. As soon as Damon Kennedy took the reins, she was transferred out of a courtroom and into the divisional office, where she filed cases other deputies would take to trial. In a way, she got lucky. She could have gotten worse. One deputy who introduced me at an election rally when I was the front runner ended up with a transfer out to the courtroom in the Antelope Valley Jail. Like Maggie, he quit. And I understood why Maggie would quit. I also understood that she would not be able to cross the aisle to defense work or take a slot in a corporate law firm. She was a dyed-in-the-wool prosecutor, and there was no choice about what she would do. It was only where she would do it. In that regard, I knew I should be happy that she was merely moving to a neighboring county and not up to San Francisco or Oakland or down to San Diego. So where are you going to look out there? Well, the job is in the city of Ventura, so either there or not too far from it. I'd like to look at Ojai, but it might be too expensive. I'm thinking Haley would fit in real well with the riding. Ojai was a crunchy, new-agey village in a mountain valley in the northern county. Years back, before we had our daughter, Maggie and I used to go there on weekends. There was even a chance our daughter was conceived there. So, this riding is not a passing thing? It could be, you never know, but she's fully engaged for now. We leased a horse for 6 months, with an option to buy. I shook my head. This was painful. Never mind my ex-wife, but Haley had told me none of this. I'm sorry, Maggie said. I know this is tough on you. I want you to know that I don't encourage it. No matter what is going on with us, I think she should have a relationship with her father. I really mean that, and that's what I tell her. I appreciate that. I didn't know what else to say. I stood up off the rock. I wanted to get out of there and go home. Can you do me a favor? I asked. What is it? I realized that I was improvising, running with a half-formed idea that had sprung from my grief and desire to somehow win my daughter back. There's a trial coming up, I said. I want her to come. You're talking about this pimp you're representing? Michael, no, I don't want her to sit through that. Besides, she has school. He's innocent. Really? Are you trying to play me like a jury now? No, I mean it. Innocent. He didn't do it, and I'm going to prove it. If Hay could be there, maybe... I don't know. I'll think about it. There's school, and I don't want her taking time off. There's also the move. Come for the verdict, both of you. Look, I have to get going. The cops are stacking up around here. Cops waiting in the office to file their cases. Okay, but think about it. All right, I will. I've got to go now. Wait, one last thing. Can you email me a picture of Haley on the horse? I'd just like to see it. Sure, I will. She disconnected after that. and I stared down at the soccer field for a few moments, replaying the conversation and trying to compute all the news about my daughter. I thought about what Legal Siegel had told me about moving on past guilt. I realized that some things were easier said than done, and some things were impossible. Chapter 24. At 7 p.m. that night, I walked down the hill and over to the little market at the base of Laurel Canyon. I called for a cab and waited 15 minutes, reading the community notices on the corkboard out front. The cab took me over the hill and down into the valley. I had the driver drop me on Ventura Boulevard by Coldwater Canyon. From there, I walked the last 5 blocks to Flex, arriving at the yoga studio shortly before 8. Kendall Roberts was busy with closing duties at the front counter. Her hair was tied up in a knot on top of her head, and there was a pencil stuck through it. The students from the last class were filing out, rolled rubber mats under their arms. I stepped in, got her attention, and asked if I could speak with her after she locked up. She hesitated. I had not told her I was coming by. "Are you hungry?" I asked. "I taught 4 classes back to back. I'm starved." "Have you ever been to Katsuya down the street here? It's pretty good. It's sushi, if you like that." "I love sushi, but I haven't been there." "Why don't I go down, get a table, and you come when you're finished here?" She hesitated again, as though she was still trying to figure out my motives. "It won't be a late night," I promised. She finally nodded. "Okay, I'll see you there. It might be 15 minutes. I need to freshen up." "Take your time. You like sake?" "Love it." "Hot or cold?" Cold. "See you there." I walked down Ventura and stepped into Katsuya, only to find the place crowded with sushi enthusiasts. There were no tables available, but I secured 2 stools at the sushi bar. I ordered the sake and some cucumber salad and pulled out my phone as I began the wait for Kendall. My ex-wife had come through with an emailed photo of my daughter and her horse. The shot showed Haley with the horse's face leaning over her shoulder from behind. The animal was black, with a white lightning bolt stripe running down its long nose. Both girl and horse were gorgeous. I was proud. But seeing the photo only added to my hurt at the news about the impending move to Ventura County. I switched over to the message app and composed a text to my daughter. She read her emails only once or twice a week, and I knew that if I wanted to get a message through without delay, I needed to text. I told her that her mother had sent me the photo of her and her horse, and that I was proud of her for pursuing riding the way she was. I also said I heard about the impending move, and that I was sorry she'd be so far away, but that I understood. I asked her if I could watch her take a lesson on the horse, and left it at that. I sent it off into the air, and foolishly thought I might get an answer soon after my phone reported the message delivered. But nothing came back. I was about to compose another text, asking if she got the first, when Kendall suddenly appeared at the open stool next to me. I put the phone in my pocket as I stood up to greet her, successfully avoiding the embarrassment that second text would have brought me. "Hi," Kendall said cheerfully. She had changed clothes at the studio and was wearing blue jeans and a peasant shirt. Her hair was down, and she looked great. "Hello," I said. "I'm glad you could make it." She kissed me on the cheek as she squeezed by me and onto the stool. It was unexpected, but nice. I poured her a cup of sake and we toasted and tasted. I watched her face for a negative reaction to the sake, but she accepted my selection. "How are you doing?" I asked. "I'm good,"